Hi, folks. Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. I'm here with the magician, Reza Manesh, we just recorded an amazing episode, which really deviates from what we've typically been doing. This is not a schema episode. This is not an unknown. This is not a human DX unknown. It's an interview with a pioneer in infectious disease regarding the COVID epidemic. I'll leave it at that for now because we have a big announcement. And the announcement is that we are lowering the price of the Clinical Problem Solvers app from $4.99 to $2.99. And really, we're doing this because we anticipate that a lot of us will be much, much, much busier, and the value potentially of having the app on your phone will likely go up. More importantly, though, we're going to be putting out a lot of COVID-related content, including illness scripts, schemas of severe pneumonia, and related diseases. And so hopefully having those at your fingertips might be helpful. Why not make it free, you may ask? Well, I'll remind you that everything that we have will always be free on the website, and really this is the price point that we've come to that allows us to continue to sustain our efforts. Remember that you can find all the schemas, illness scripts, tutorials, everything is on our app. All right, so now with that announcement in mind, I'll transition to Reza to tell us a little bit more about today's episode, including our special guest.
Thank you so much, Robbie. I really can't thank our expert enough for joining us on such short notice. His name is Dr. Carlos Del Rio, who is Hubert Professor and Chair of the Hubert Department of Global Health at the Rowland School of Public Health of Emory University and Professor of Medicine at Emory University School of Medicine. Dr. Del Rio is a native of Mexico, where he was executive director of the National AIDS Council of Mexico from 1992 through 1996. He was also a member of the Program Coordinating Board of United Nations AIDS from 1995 to 1997. And I also learned that he was former long COVID resident at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, where he initially wanted to become a cardiologist, but then he worked with the legendary Dr. John Bartlett and decided to pursue his passion in HIV/AIDS.
Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Hi, I'm Emma Levine. I'm a fourth-year medical student at the University of California, San Francisco, and honored to be a member of the CP Solvers family. I'm joined today with my co-hosts Charmin, Saman, Robbie, and Reza for a special episode regarding COVID-19. We are very excited to be joined by Dr. Carlos Del Rio. Hello, Carlos. Thank you for taking the time to join us on such short notice.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you guys today.
All right. In this episode, we will ask Carlos questions related to COVID-19. Thank you all for your thoughtful questions on Twitter. We will include several of them during this episode. I'll start by kicking it off. So I went out to dinner last night to try and do my part to support small local businesses while also practicing social distancing. And a question that came up multiple times at different tables, and I think one of the biggest questions that we all have, is why are people buying all the toilet paper?
You know, that's a great question, and I have no idea. But I do have a couple of theories.
Amazing.
You know, since people have read that Caletra, lopinavir, ritonavir may be useful for treatment, and everybody then found out that Caletra produces a side effect, diarrhea, I guess people are just prophylactically buying it because, you know, we may be all taking Caletra. I mean, that's the only explanation I have.
Carlos, that's the toughest question you're going to get on this episode.
I mean, I'm baffled by the toilet paper dilemma.
All right. Well, Charmin, why don't we let you
thank
start?
Thank you so much, Carlos, for being here. I was wondering if you don't mind just like giving us an overview of what is the spectrum of presentation when it comes to COVID.
Well, that's a really good question. And I think we've learned a lot by talking to our colleagues and by reading the articles that are coming from different places, and primarily in China. But I think what we're learning is that the clinical presentation, you know, characteristically is that of an illness with fever and a dry cough. But fever is only present maybe in about 80% and 90% of patients, but it may not be present in the first 48 hours of the illness. So you may come in a febrile and then have fever develop. And the cough is only present in about 50 to 60% of people. You can have other manifestations like malaise, headache, diarrhea, you know, in 10 to 20%, 15% of people. We just had a patient recently that essentially presented with abdominal pain, diarrhea, and had a fever. And the patient went to CT, and it was during CT that they saw some grand grass appearance on the lower lobes of the lung. So they said, oh, let's go to a chest CT. And they did a whole chest CT, and it was full of grand glass opacities. And then that's how we led to the diagnosis. But the patient had no respiratory symptoms. So I really worry that the clinical syndrome is not specific enough for us to be identifying all patients.
All right, Saman, you're up now.
All right. Well, thank you again, Carlos, for joining us today. You know, a lot of our listeners are medical students and house staff officers, and, you know, they are very much at the front line and taking care of a lot of these sick patients. And so, you know, one question that I get asked a lot is, you know, what do we do in these situations if, you know, the house staff gets exposed and before they have any symptoms, you know, should they be quarantining themselves, even if they are asymptomatic? You know, what are some of the steps that exposed house staff should be doing?
So there's several. It's a very tricky question, and it's very complicated because, as you know, if we could identify the patients, then house staff should not be exposed. But the problem is we're not knowing when there's community transmission. People can be exposed in the hospital, but you can also be exposed, you know, by going to the grocery store, quite frankly, or in the community, right? The only site of exposure is not just the hospital. We do know from our Chinese colleagues that a lot of the transmission has occurred either within households or at healthcare facilities. So particularly I'm concerned about healthcare facilities. And I think we need to, you know, if I had the resources, I would mask with a surgical mask every patient that came into the clinic or into the registration area, in particular if they have a fever, certainly if they have respiratory, but even without fever. And then I think that house officers need to, you know, be really careful, wash your hands, do practice hand hygiene, you know, use a mask if they're evaluating the patient, use properly, be trained in proper use of PPE. But you can still get exposed and get infected. And if you're exposed, I mean, I think you need to be evaluated. And each hospital will have different rules and different regulations of what you can do. And even when I've seen people, you know, if somebody went into self-quarantine because they were exposed, there are things they can still do, you know, as far as helping triage phones and discuss with people about, you know, patients and information. So there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done. You don't necessarily need to be back in the hospital. In general, the quarantine recommended is you know, 14 days. But again, we're not really recommending quarantine at this point in time at a national level. And now if you get exposed and you get infected, I think it's a different story. Then you're talking about isolation and you're talking about management and treatment of that individual.
That's incredible. I really liked how you brought in the notion of, like, even if you're not able to be in the hospital, there's so much that we as physicians, as medical providers can do to really kind of flatten the curve. So I really appreciate you mentioning that. Robbie, what questions do you
Thank you again, Carlos, for the opportunity to learn from your expertise. I'm curious. I'm really intrigued by the transmission. And so can you speak a little bit to how this virus is transmitted from maybe just focusing on the person-to-person transmission that's happening now?
Oh, I think we're all fascinated and intrigued by the transmission. I think there's several things that we know on the transmission of this virus. And I think that that for one thing, we know that the transmission happens, you know, through respiratory secretions and primarily through droplets and primarily through large droplets. And you can also get small droplets in the transmission. We know that we're pretty certain, I think, that is not airborne. And we also know that when you're talking about the transmission of this virus, that a lot of the potential transmission could occur with contact with innate surfaces. And so I can have a cough and then I could touch my hand and then I'll touch let's say a doorknob, and then you come in, you touch the doorknob, and then you touch your mucosas and you get infected. And the transmission from through this mechanism depends on how much the virus survives in surfaces. And this can go anywhere from some minutes up to, you know, 9 hours or more, depending on the surface, depending on the temperature. So it really emphasized the importance of our hands. You know, John Brooks recently at a presentation he did at CROI, he said, our hands are precious. We need to take care of them, wash them frequently, keep them clean, because it could be a vehicle of transmission. On the other side, we know, you know, there's been a lot of questions about stool. And while RNA has been identified in stool, no live virus has been identified in stool. So we don't think there's transmission through the fecal route. And finally, so far, there's no evidence of perinatal transmission. So the news is I think at this point is becoming pretty clear that we're talking about a respiratory pathogen transmitted through droplets and some contact.
Hey, Emma, this isn't counted as my question. Rezi here. It's just a follow-up to Robbie. Carlos, there's talk about when you're going to do a procedure like an intubation or if someone goes on BiPAP, that there's increased risk for transmission. It's very important to have your N95 or your PPE equipment on. I was curious about high-flow nasal cannula. Is there also increased risk for transmission if a patient is placed on high-flow nasal cannula?
So you're asking a really good question. And I'm certainly not an ICU specialist, but talking to our ICU colleagues, they're really talking about not doing BiPAP and doing actually early intubations in these individuals. And, you know, probably high-flow nasal cannula may be okay, but certainly high-flow oxygen and, you know, a oxygen rebreather or a BiPAP would not be the appropriate way to go.
Since Reza interject, I'm interjecting too. My intern actually just got a call asking that a patient who's we're waiting for his test result to come back to have the nebulizers changed to MDIs. Can you also like comment about risk of aerosolization with NEBs?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would avoid nebulizers in individuals with this illness because, again, that's for the same reason CDC from the very beginning said, you know, don't do induced sputums, right? Do a expectorated sputum. But induced sputum, again, increases, you have to nebulize, it increases the risk of transmission. So in general, we don't want to do anything that will increase the risk of generating aerosols.
Thank you.
Amazing. All right.
Wait, he just asked that.
So my first question is from a good friend of mine, Christina Hager, Dr. Christina Hager, who's a resident at the University of Pittsburgh. Carlos, if you can comment on her comment that she made on Twitter, which is, I think there's a lot of confusion regarding strategies versus containment and how travel bans limiting migration plays into all of this because some of it seems counterintuitive. So I guess commenting on just containment versus mitigation and travel bans and what your perspective is on those topics.
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing I'm going to say is that I'm going to use this to sort of say that I want to remind everybody of the different sites that journals have put together. And in JAMA, there is a paper that just came out at that site that has actually came out yesterday. It is called From Containment to Mitigation in the United States. And I would strongly encourage people to read it. It's a short paper. It's well done. And just goes into the different levels of what do we mean by containment versus what do we mean by mitigation and what we're talking about. I think when we talk about containment, we're really talking about those strategies that will allow us to find cases, to isolate them, to do contact tracing. It really is about that preparedness component is that, you know, early stage in which you're trying to prevent the number of cases to go up as much as possible. But at some point in time in virus like this one, and I love, you know, Mike Osterholm, who says, you know, trying to stop this virus or a respiratory virus by containment is a little bit like trying to stop the wind. I think about a hurricane, and you know, you're not going to be able to stop a hurricane because it's coming your way. So at some point in time, transmission outpaces containment efforts. And then you have to go to mitigation in which now you're talking about, you know, identification, isolation, social distancing, medical care. So you're talking about decreasing the impact. And some of those strategies kind of work together. And I think some of you have seen sort of the cash, you know, the hashtag, you know, flatten the curve. And what we're trying to do is really to flatten the curve. And I think residents will understand this very well. If I tell a resident, you're going to get 30 admissions, and the resident says, over what period of time? And the resident, I said, over a month. The resident said, that's not a big deal. I'll take care of that. But if I said, no, you're going to get 30 admissions tomorrow, you're going to say, oh, well, I'll be overwhelmed, right? So you want to flatten the curve. You maybe get 30 admissions, but make sure you get them over a longer period of time. And that flattening of the curve is a critical component of not overwhelming our healthcare systems. And therefore, that combination is critical to do that.
Thank you so much, Carl. It's very helpful.
May I interject with a question related to that, Carlos? So,
sure.
I I definitely agree with the social distancing, and I definitely agree with all the schools, you know, closing down to prevent that. I feel like I'm not sure what your thoughts are as far as the timing of that. Some schools are doing, you know, 2 to 4 weeks, and if we're just seeing barely the rate of increase, I was wondering what your thoughts are as far as like the timing of how much time social distancing should be done and when we can start to integrate again. You know, when we start seeing cases really decrease, or is it going back to a certain rate that you think would be comfortable for all of us to get back together again?
Well, so a lot of really good questions. First of all, I would say that school closure is and has been, as you probably have seen, a sort of a fairly controversial topic, and there's a lot of question whether it's the right thing to do or not the right thing to do. And in general, if you're going to do it, and has been shown in pandemics, if you're going to do it, you probably need to do it early as opposed to do it late. The sooner you do it, the better it is. Now, there is articles, there is data in school closure. There was an article, I remember, in Annals of Internal Medicine, I think like in 2012, in which they look at the pandemic of H1N1 in 2009, and they found that the school closure was actually associated with greater transmission because people stayed home and there's transmission in the household. So I think the school closure is still, I think, a very controversial topic. But the data from pandemic influenza is that the sooner you do it, the better it is. And if you're going to do it, you do it early. How long do you close schools for? I think it's a big question. But one thing also is we know also from several studies that school closure leads to disadvantage the poor people, right? Because if you're a father or mother that works on an hourly basis in a service industry and your kids are home, then all of a sudden, you know, you may be missing work to take care of your kids and you don't have a paycheck. And it's very different than somebody who has means and is able to stay home. So that creates a lot of tricky things. And I think we need to think that when we're closing schools, we're not creating increasing health disparities and disproportionately affecting those that are most at need.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing up such important issues. I think especially also like looking at healthcare providers as well, like fighting the battle, and a lot of their kids are also out of school as well, and it can be very challenging. Kind of touching back onto your comparison with the flu, I was wondering, is this worse than the flu? And what are some things that we look at to kind of compare the two?
So that's a really good question again. And you know, this is not the flu. And I try to remind this to people that when I hear people say this is just the flu, this is not just the flu. For to starters, this is a disease that appears to have a mortality, which is about 10 times out of the flu. You know, seasonal flu has a mortality of 0.1%. This appears to have a mortality of 1% or higher. Number two, you know, in seasonal flu, we all have certain degree of immunity, right? I mean, because it's continuously happened. And even if we don't get vaccinated, we have some level of immunity from repetitive episodes of influenza at repetitive seasons. In the flu, we also have a vaccine, and you know, if you get a vaccine, you get some level of protection. And finally, in the flu, we have treatments, we have drugs that we can use. So the combination of those things make this very different. Here we have a virus that has a novel virus to which there is no immunity. I tell people we are, our immune system is naked to this virus, and to which we have no vaccine and no treatment. That creates conditions that make it very different than the flu.
Thank you so much. Charmaine, what questions do you have?
Ooh, so many. Where do I even start? I was just wondering about your thoughts about testing. I've been reading like a little article about that. We are low on the reagents that are used to test for COVID. What are your thoughts on that?
So we have a couple of issues there. You know, number one, I would say that a new test needed to be developed. And again, there were some mishaps in the developing of the test. And again, I would really point your listeners to the JAMA COVID site, because there was just an article there published about testing. And I thought it was a really, really good article looking at the issues around testing and what issues we need to look at and what the problem has been. The testing conundrum and the testing faux pas, I think, is one will be remembered as one of the biggest problems we've had in this epidemic here in the United States. And what those problems were due to is a little too complicated. I'm not a clinical pathologist. It's a little too technical sometimes. My wife's a clinical pathologist and she's tried to explain to me. But you have three primers. And even though we keep on hearing CDC talk about a test kit, it's not a kit. It's just, you know, CDC put together, they develop what's called an LDT or laboratory developed test. And they put a primers into a set of a little, you know, bag with the primers and this, that, and the other. And then they had to get a negative control in there. And they were having some challenges around the negative control. And that created some problems with the test. And therefore they had to recall and not distribute the test and get them validated and get that improved. But it's not a test that, you know, it's a kit. It's not available like that. And therefore, because you also have a test with three primers, when you think about a PCR, if you have one channel, you have to run three different channels, right? So at the same time, it also makes it a very slow test to run. So now the issue, now that they've solved the issues with the test and everybody says, oh, the test is great, now we have a million tests. What we don't have in many places is a capacity to run many tests, because there's a throughput problem, right? You don't have enough PCR machines out there. We don't have enough technicians to run the test. So now what you have is a throughput problem. So we need, we desperately need better ways to think about testing. And quite frankly, I'm embarrassed about where we are, because, you know, South Korea is testing about 20,000 people a day. The U.S. has tested less than 10,000 people in 2 months. You know, it's just ridiculous where we are. And I really think, you know, if we were a developing country, we would be asking for technical assistance from the Koreans. And we would say, please, guys, come over here and tell us how to do this. Because quite frankly, we fumble it big time. Now, I would say that I'm very encouraged by two things. Number one, I was encouraged by the press conference yesterday in the White House and seeing, you know, Debbie Birx take care of this, because Debbie has experience of really sort of scaling up HIV viral load testing throughout Africa. And number two, so she knows how to do this in resource limited environments. And I think right now our public health system around the country is a resource limited setting. We have cut down so much funding for public health that I would say our public health infrastructure is that of a resource limited setting. And number two, we have, Admiral Brent Gerard also working on this, I think is really good. He is a go-getter. He's somebody who knows how to do things and is really going to get it accomplished. And then number three, having the CEOs of many of the firms like Roche and other manufacturers up there, I think they're going to help us. But more importantly, I think they're going to develop better tests, because quite frankly, we need to move to something that is like a rapid test, an EIA, an antigen detection test, a serology. We need a test that is as good and something that you can run quickly, something that you can run inside your BioFire, right? The BioFires right now has SARS, MERS. We need to get BioFire to also have this test in there. It should not be run independent of the BioFire. Right now, at least at my institution, we're doing an influenza test. If negative, we're doing a BioFire. If negative, they're doing the COVID. And the health department is having us do all that, quite frankly, just because it's a way of stalling it, right? Because they have so many tests to do that they're trying to to find a reason to say, okay, you got influenza, that's it, right? No more testing required. But the reality is we need a better test and a better approach. And until we solve our testing conundrum, I think our public health response to this epidemic is really hampered.
Twitter followers, Dr. Harrison Kolodimos, says the following. As a Seattle area PCP, I have access to COVID testing, but struggling to determine who is appropriate to test. Particularly, there's a large group of people with mild, moderate illness, cough, but no exposures or measured fever.
I would say that his question is a really good question. And I think increasingly, because there is community transmission, we're testing a lot more people and the testing algorithms no longer are useful. In my mind, what we need to do is think about if you as a clinician think a test is useful, I would go ahead and order it. I would give, again, credit to University of Washington. The reason University of Washington discovered their community outbreak that we're having is because their researchers had developed a laboratory-developed test, and they're starting to test, as part of the influenza surveillance, people that samples they had there. So if you test, you find, right? If you test, you discover cases. One of the things to talk about the test that I think we need to know, and again, my wife educated me on this, now that we have tests, also, the other challenge in the throughput is that we're running out of RNA extraction material. Because, you know, you get the swab, you still need to extract the RNA from the sample. And that is something that is also running out. So the manufacturers of the RNA extraction kits or extraction material are running behind. So I think our testing problem is a big one in some that, quite frankly, I haven't seen resolved. You know, they keep on telling us, oh, in a couple of weeks, we'll be doing 1 million tests. Great. I hope we get there because we clinicians need tests. We need to be able to see a patient and decide you need to be tested and get a test and do it like, you know, no different than we do an influenza test today, quite frankly.
I'm gonna practice my interjection skills too. Thank you, Carlos. This was super helpful. And just to piggyback on something you said a little while ago, which is sort of implying that the COVID disease lives in a spectrum of diseases that it accompanies, like influenza and the other biofire organisms available on the biofire. Can you speak to the frequency of co-infection and whether the most of the algorithms now that are based on identifying other respiratory infections, how they should influence our thinking about COVID?
So, in general, we're not thinking about co-infection, but the reality is that there is reports of co-infection. And in fact, you know, I go back even several weeks ago, it feels like years ago, but several weeks ago, the first patient the first person that died in the Philippines was somebody that actually, in the report, it said it had died with co-infection with influenza and then strep pneumonia. So I think you start thinking about this as if there's a possibility of co-infection. But I think co-infection has been relatively rare. And I think it's been relatively rare because the way I think about it is, you know, there's only so many cells you can get infected in your lungs, right? And if you have one virus there and it's taken over that cell, then other viruses don't come in. And you also have to remember that during viral infections, you know, virus make the immune system produce interference, which sort of then protect the cells from other viral infections. So I have not seen a lot of co-infection. I think it's possible, but I don't think it's as common as you would like it, as you would think it would be.
Amazing.
Perfect. Sorry, I was just going to, I guess this can also be my question.
You can ask too.
Going along with the testing, there's been like a recent JAMA article that's went through a little bit of the sensitivity of the PCR testing across BAL, sputum, nasopharyngeal, oropharyngeal, blood, stool, urine, things like that. I know it's very early to tell, but how reliable do you think the testing is? And how do you think about like the sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictive values of this test? Like if we have a high pretest probability and we have a swab that is negative, you know, what should we do in those situations?
Well, again, you know, I think if you have three primers, you're going to have the sensitivity is not going to be as good if you need to have the criteria for a positive test. I still think we don't know. I've never seen anything published on sensitivity and specificity, but let's assume the sensitivity is pretty good. If you have a pretest probability of disease, which is high, then you're going to have a very high positive predictive value. But if the pretest probability is low, then your positive predictive value is going to drop significantly. I do think that you need good specimens, and I want to emphasize to people that the best specimen is obviously a deep specimen. But if you're doing oral swabs, are increasingly being discouraged. CDC wants, and most health departments want nasopharyngeal swabs. And I want to remind people that it getting a good nasopharyngeal specimen is not easy. There's a great New England Journal of Medicine video showing how to do a good nasopharyngeal swab. And I remember one time when I had influenza, and I went to our lab, and our lab director got a swab on me and stuck that swab on my nose. And, you know, all of a sudden a tear came down my eye, and she said, "Perfect, this is the right sample. You know, until you get an ear out of your participant, you haven't gotten a good sample." And the point is, you know, you have to really push hard. This is not just a little bit swab up your nose. This nasopharyngeal, you got to get way back there. And therefore, I think people may not be, I mean, the problem with the test may not be the test, but it may be the sample. So is what pathologists call a pre-analytical problem, right? It's not the analytical, but if you don't get a good sample, your pre-analytical is bad, and therefore you don't get a good result. So let's think about that, is that if we don't have a good sample, your test is not going to be good, but it's not because the test is not good, it's because you have a pre-analytical problem.
Amazing. I guess kind of my turn to interject. Kind of going off of that, like, can you speak to the role of imaging and like how that kind of plays into testing?
Well, that's a good question. So at some point in time, the Chinese said, oh, you know, we're because we don't have enough tests, we're screening people with CAT scans, right? And they were doing CAT scan screening. Yeah. I don't think we need to be doing that. I mean, I honestly think that, having said that, I told you about the patient that we had changes in the CAT scan, and we have some radiologists saying, oh, we ought to be doing that. I don't think I would do that. But having said that, I think imaging is fairly characteristic with this gram grass appearances. And I think we need to be aware of that. But, you know, those of us that have been in the era of HIV, you know, sometimes say, yeah, those gram grass appearances, that's actually PCP. So also remember that not everything with a gram grass appearance, you know, there's this whole issue of what we call, you know, anchoring in clinical medicine, that you start thinking about something all the time, and before you know it, that's the only thing you think about. And we still have to remember that there's other diseases in the community that we're going to be confronting.
Thank you so much. I'll let Robbie take it away.
Oh, thank you. So, Carlos, I think you gave us a terrific overview of sort of the components of the illness and component of the presenting features. Excuse me. I'm just hoping to get clarity on how if the syndrome is going to be severe, if someone is going to end up in the ICU, how do those symptoms typically evolve? Do they get very sick very suddenly usually, or does it take time for them to get sick, or how does the story play out over time?
So, again, what we're not totally sure, but we've seen different things. I mean, some, the you know, the Chinese talk about, you know, 80% of people having mild disease, and about 20% of people requiring hospitalization. And those that require hospitalization, about a third of those that require hospitalization end up in the ICU, and about 5 to 10% require mechanical ventilation. But then you hear data from Italy, and the numbers are very different. A lot more hospitalization, a lot more ICU care, a lot more mortality. And I think it really has to do with the age of the population, right? If the population, China has a much younger population, so I think the spectrum is very different than if you have, you know, in Northern Italy, or for example, a nursing home in Seattle, then you have a lot of older people. I think the spectrum is going to be much more severe. So I think the clinical spectrum, I think it's going to be very dependent on three things. Number one, age. Number two, comorbid conditions, and number three, probably something related to inoculum, right? I mean, how much virus you have, how much exposure you have. There is, you know, something that to all of us has been baffling is how little disease there's in kids. And what we're beginning to think is that there's not that as little, they don't get infected, they just have very little, very, very mild clinical illness. So there may be some component of there's an article that talked about antibody dependent enhancement, you know, ADE, very similar to what we see in dengue. So maybe people in the past that have been exposed to other diseases may have a reaction to this virus. I think a lot of it, understanding the immunology and the pathogenesis in this disease is still one of the questions we have.
Terrific. Thank you.
Reza, it's your turn.
Thank you, Emma. Carlos, once you get infected with coronavirus, thereafter, are you immune? I asked this question because in doing some research, I learned there's two strains that have been identified, an L-type and an S-type. So I was just wondering, like, once you get infected, do you still have to take certain precautions, or are you immune to COVID-19?
So again, this is something that we desperately need answers to, right? I would love to say that you become immune, and the data, at least from talking to colleagues in China, they say most people that have recovered don't get it again. There has been some reports of co-infection, but most people that have recovered don't get it again. So there's got to be some immunity. And that's what we've seen in other coronaviruses like SARS, but would love to get more data. I think we need more immunological data. I hope there's immunity, because otherwise a vaccine would not be very successful. And those of us that have been working in HIV have realized how difficult it is to develop a vaccine for that disease. So obviously, we hope that this vaccine is much better, and actually a vaccine that gives you robust immunity in a way similar to other infectious diseases like measles or influenza. Even, I mean, even if we got a vaccine with 40% efficacy, I would be very pleased, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. So the immunity to this disease, I think it needs to be worked out. But obviously it's something very important because, in Ebola, for example, one of the things that was done in patients with Ebola here in the U.S. and here at Emory, one of the things that we did with sick individuals with Ebola is we had convalescent serum from patients that had recovered from Ebola and use that for treatment. So that's a question that also, could you use convalescent serum people that have recovered to treat others? So far, that doesn't appear to have been utilized extensively, so we don't have any data about it.
Amazing. I think kind of jumping off of the idea of treatment, what do you recommend for first-line treatment, and when do we decide between putting a patient on a clinical trial or not?
Good questions, right? Because first of all, as a clinician investigator, I love clinical trials. This is what I do. I think clinical trials have gotten us where we are in HIV. But if it wasn't for clinical research, we would not be where we are. So I tend to like clinical trials, and there's a variety of clinical trials, both sponsored by DMED and sponsored by NIH. There are a bunch of clinical trials. I mean, I think the Gilead phase 3 trial. It's evaluating the efficacy of remdesivir, and if at all possible, I would like to involve somebody in a clinical trial if they qualify. If they don't, Gilead also has compassionate use remdesivir, and hopefully you can use it. And if that's the case, again, we need to know if remdesivir works. In my mind, right now, for most people, you need no treatment. It's just supportive care, and that's it. But if somebody has moderate to severe disease, I think consider a clinical trial will be important. Now, somebody the other day said to me, well, if it's a placebo study, I don't want to participate. I want to go directly to remdesivir. And that's a possibility. But some of the studies are being designed with an adaptive design. So you could potentially not necessarily be randomized to the placebo arm. There's other things that are being tried. There's a lot of clinical trials happening. To me, the most promising drug is remdesivir, but we still have have to prove that it works. As I mentioned before, Caletra or lopinavir, ritonavir, there's some data from MERS that it works, but it's in animal models, and so far the data that I've seen in cases of this disease is not impressive at all. It doesn't seem to decrease the viral load. It doesn't seem to do anything. So I'm not convinced that this is going to be the do all treat all kind of thing. And then there's a bunch of other things that have been tried all the way to, quite frankly, all the way to to Chinese traditional medicine and other things. I think we're pretty limited in our approach. There's some drugs that are being developed, but again, we are way back to where we would like to be. There's this very interesting data of whether we can use antibodies from survivors to treat patients, and goes back to the immunity, right? And some people say that maybe that's what you can do, and that would be an interesting approach if you can actually do that, because then you can potentially work on developing monoclonal antibodies or other things that you can use for treatment. And in fact, I think Takeda Pharmaceutical is beginning to test that. You know, one question that I think would be important, because I think residents and I had a lot of questions about, is this whole issue of masks, right? Which mask do I need and how do I need? Is it N95 or surgical mask, et cetera?
Can that be my question, Emma? That I want that to count as my final question. Carlos, please educate us.
I think that should be Carlos's question. Okay.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of questions about what mask to use, which is a mask, what are the different types of masks. And we need to remind people the difference between an N95 mask and a surgical mask. And a surgical mask is the kind of mask that we use, to prevent something from getting outside. So if you have somebody with a cough or respiratory illness, tuberculosis or influenza, you put a surgical mask in them to prevent them from disseminating. And an N95 or respirator mask is the kind of mask that you as a healthcare provider use to prevent something from coming from the outside. So we have been recommending in this disease and in others for the patient to have a surgical mask and for us to have an N95 mask. But if you look at the literature is very sparse. And I want to point people to an article published in JAMA last year that was actually, again, a randomized control trial. And the randomized control trial compared N95 respirators to medical masks for preventing influenza among healthcare personnel. And in this study, among outpatient healthcare providers, not inpatient, outpatient healthcare providers, an N95 respirator versus surgical mask as worn by healthcare participants had no difference in the incidence of laboratory confirmed influenza. So if you can get a good surgical mask, you're probably protected as a healthcare provider, unless you're doing a high aerosolization procedure or an intubation or something like that. But if you're just seeing somebody in the outpatient clinic, you don't need an N95 respirator. Having said that, I still believe because of the transmission that you do need a face shield or goggles or something to protect your eyes. But the whole issue of the mask, I think, and CDC, in fact, Health Canada has already, relaxed the recommendations. And CDC also recently relaxed the recommendations around N95s. But unfortunately, they put something in their recommendations that was very sort of government, very CDC-like. It said, something like if there's a low supply or something like that, that in my mind was a little bit like waffly. It wasn't like what I would like to see. If I look at the exact wording, it was something like, during this, if you have low availability, you can do this. And it just gives you the sense of, again, us being a developing country, right? If you don't have this, then you can do this. I think they need to be a little more strict and just say, look, it works just as well. And that's what the literature shows, at least for influenza.
Now, going back to the transmission, and thank you so much, Carlos, for all this wonderful information. I was wondering about window of infectivity for patients and how many days are they considered contagious?
Oh, such a great question, right? So we know that you probably are, the median incubation period is about 5 days. It ranges about from 2 to 14. There's some data suggesting that you can be infectious before you become symptomatic. But again, talking to Chinese colleagues, they said, yeah, it's possible, but it's rare. Most of the transmission occurs actually from symptomatic individuals. Again, I want to stress this transmission in clinical settings. And in clinical settings, we have symptomatic people. And I want to stress the transmission in households. But then once you recover, how long are you you're infectious for? And it's not very clear, and it's not well known. And most of us feel that if you have recovered clinically, you are no longer infectious. But the data on infectivity, I think is one that we still need to have better data. There's some articles out there saying you can be shedding virus for as long as a month. But I think a lot of those are based on you can shedding RNA. And the question is, okay, fine, that's RNA, but is that viable virus? Is that infectious virus? Are you still infectious at that point? And I'm not sure the answer to that is yes. So we need better data on infectivity. But at this point in time, I think what we need to say is, look, as a healthcare provider, I go back to the early years of HIV, and we started, when I was a a house officer, I'm talking many years ago, because when I started my internship, HIV was only starting. We didn't use gloves to do any procedures. You know, we just used gloves if we thought the patient had hepatitis or something like that. But, you know, normally you wouldn't put gloves to do, you know, to do a blood draw on somebody because it wasn't, you know, high risk. But then with HIV, we moved to this whole idea of universal precautions, right? Which is now the standard of care. We treat everybody as if they're infectious. I think with this virus, maybe it's about time that we start thinking about universal respiratory precautions, right? About the fact that we need to use masks in the future because we're not going to know who has something that is transmissible like this.
Amazing. I know Saman has one more question.
Hi again. So we know that the virus has an affinity to the ACE2 receptors, and there's lots of controversy that we see or questions that we see on Twitter and questions that I get as far as what to do, what's the pathophysiology behind this and its affinity to ACE2 receptors. Is there a connection between that and hypertension and coronary artery disease? And what should we do with patients that are on ACE inhibitors? Should we continue it? Should we stop it? What are your thoughts on that?
So those are really good questions, and there have been a couple of articles about it. You know, the ACE2 receptor is right. It's an enzyme, right? And it's actually very prominent in the lung tissue, and we know that this is the target also of of other viruses like the SARS-CoV uses the same receptor, and it is that interface between the ACE2 and the viral spike protein that seems to be critical in disease in viral attachment and entry to the cell. So you know, in animals experiments, it's been shown that that using an ACE inhibitor like lisinopril could significantly increase mRNA expression in cardiac ACE2. And is there a link? Could this possibly be the case? And I've been trying to ask the Chinese because they should have the data. They keep on saying hypertension is a risk factor. And I keep on asking, okay, it's a risk factor, but what were they getting treated for their hypertension? Were they on an ACE inhibitor, or were they on an ARB, or they were in something different? Because I think that's going to be critical. And it may very well be that ACE inhibitors have a role in increasing the risk of disease. And that's something that we need to learn. That's something that we need to know very quickly, right? Because at this point in time, we don't know the answer. I mean, there's so many, you know, I keep on thinking about this, and I keep on saying how much research could potentially happen and how much great opportunities, not only for those of us in ID, but those of us in cardiology and vascular disease and pulmonary and so many fields. And I think, again, it's so exciting to think about the research potential that we can have in really changing the course of an illness. And again, emphasize that it is research of thinking in these clinical questions and doing the research that really gets us the answers and gets us the to a better place.
That's incredible. My dad always loves to say, never stop learning because life never stops teaching. Kind of to wrap it up and ask one last question, what good has come out of this pandemic?
Well, you know, I think the good that I've seen so far is I've been impressed to see how the medical journals have created specific sites and have made it behind the, you know, op- drop the paywall for all these articles. But you know, the question that I have for journals, okay, I said, okay, well, that's with this epidemic, but we have had other pandemics, right? There's a pandemic of HIV and there's a pandemic of many other diseases out there, and why not drop the paywall for those? So I think it's going to make us rethink about how we deal with how we share information. The other thing is, I think it's again, it will make us rethink how underfunding global health and underfunding public health is a problem. And one of my heroes is Dr. Bill Foege. And one time I heard Bill say something great that I would like to repeat. And he used to say that quoting Dolly Parton, he said, you have no idea how expensive it is to look this cheap. And, you know, we have underspent in public health. And now we're going to have to pay millions, if not billions, in dealing with this epidemic. And you know, it's time to rethink about investing appropriately in public health and in global health, because we would not be where we are if that hadn't been the case. So I've been bringing that focus. And I think the other focus is, you know, those of us in ID have been talking about how ID is undervalued and we need more people to go into ID. And I think this pandemic is a great opportunity for us to say, hey, ID is really important. It needs support. We need more people going into ID. We need to pay ID people, you know, correctly, because we need people attracted to ID, because ID doctors are critical in this epidemic. And when, you know, when the next pandemic comes, you want to have those ID doctors around. So, you know, it's highlighted a lot of things, and hopefully I'll think about something else, you know, that is, there's this conversation happening all the way from the White House of saying, you know, people are not going to have to pay for tests. People are not going to have to pay for care. Well, I mean, maybe we need to pay, have people not pay for care for anything, right? It's a time to go to a national health insurance as opposed to this broken market we have. So maybe the good out of this is going to be that we're going to rehab a discussion again about our healthcare financing in this country and how broken it is, and how, quite frankly, thinking about addressing a pandemic in a market where you have insurance and you have markets and you have, you know, uninsured people makes absolutely no sense. So I'm hoping that that discussion will be made about, you know, the need to have a different, very different way to think about financing healthcare as a result of this.
And if I may interject real quick, I just wanted to say that one very microscopic good that clearly is evident to me is just this group hanging out here. And we're especially grateful to you, Carlos, for sharing your expertise with us. But also wanted to throw in a quick thanks and gratitude for Emma, who, you know, on a whim today, this morning, just really is leading, coordinating this episode. And to Reza, who did all the background work to make it happen. So one microscopic thing. Gratitude to all of you here and to everyone who's listening and everyone on Twitter who submitted their questions. We're all grateful for all of you coming together and for the individuals on this call.
You know, one last thing that I would say to conclude is that this is the first pandemic of the social media era. And I think the way that Twitter is playing and the way that social media is playing is both good and bad. There's a lot of misinformation out there, but there's also some great information. And I think a podcast like this is a great information.
Absolutely. I also want to second Robbie's comment. I really think being able to see so many people come together through a time of crisis is really inspiring to me as a medical student who will be entering residency in a few short months. I really want to thank you, Carlos, like Robbie said, for really taking the time to join us on such short notice and providing such rich content and discussion and thinking about something so that has affected so many people. I was wondering if you have any other thoughts before we wrap up this episode.
I mean, my only thought is that, you know, this is stay involved. If you're in medicine, this is our time. This is when we can make a difference. And I think if we all work together, we have a role to play in clinical medicine and public health in our communities, educating people about social distancing, about what needs to be done, passing information. And really, we all have a role to play. But at the end, this too shall pass. We're going to defeat this virus. We're going to defeat this epidemic. And we're going to get over. And I think we're all going to be happy and better at the end of that. You know, I read the other day somebody say that epidemics are like washing machines. You know, they throw you, they toss you, they twist you. But at the end, you come out cleaner, brighter, and smarter.
I love it. To our listeners, we'd greatly appreciate your feedback. We'd love to know if you found this episode helpful and if you'd like more of these types of episodes.
That's a wrap, folks.